Hello and welcome to the BICOM podcast. I'm Richard Pater, the director of BICOM. Today is the 14th of March. It's also the 160th day of the war and the fifth day of Ramadan. Today, my guest is Professor Kobi Mikhaeli. Kobi, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
So for background, Kobi is a senior researcher at the INSS and the Misgav Institute, and he also has a UK connection as a visiting professor at the International Centre for Policing and Security at the University of South Wales. In the past, Professor Mikhael has served as the Deputy Director General and Head of the Palestinian Desk at the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, and he has a variety of affiliations with academic institutions both in Israel and around the world. And finally, he's also published a number of books, some of which whose topics we will discuss today. But in broad strokes, his area of expertise includes the Palestinian arena, conflict resolution, military strategy, and national security. So, Professor, thank you again. If I can start off and just get your overall assessment, perhaps, of how you think the IDF is progressing within its the confrontations and conflict inside the Gaza Strip.
Thank you for having me, Richard. It's my pleasure. It looks that the accumulation of the achievements, the IDF achievements, is very impressive. I mean, in any comparison to any other urban battle zone in the last three or four decades, be it in Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, or any other place, the IDF faces the most complicated urban zone warfare. I mean, we are talking about a terror organization composed of 40,000 militants, which is so deeply embedded in the civil society to the level that, according to the findings or according to the details that were informed by the IDF. Something around 80% of the entire buildings in the Gaza Strip that the IDF reached to were infected by Hamas in this way or another. And in addition to that, infected by Hamas means that Hamas used these buildings and civilian facilities for military and terrorist purposes. And in addition to that, in more than a decade, Hamas has succeeded in building a web spider infrastructure of tunnels, more than 500 kilometers of tunnels, with all the military equipment and all the other equipment which is required for a long stay, and all the infrastructure beneath the ground is directly connected to the infrastructure on the ground. So the situation is very, very complicated. We are talking about the most populated area in the world, a very small place. And therefore, I think that when we take into consideration the ratio of the collateral damage, we are talking about a very, very impressive ratio of collateral damage. Actually, is the lowest since ever. And this is not... according to my interpretation, we have to listen carefully what to things that have been said by Richard Kemp from the UK or John Spencer from the US. I think that in this regard, the achievements are very impressive. But in the very same time, we haven't reached yet to the strategic impact or the ultimate strategic impact that we are willing to reach to. And although 18 to 20 battalions out of 24 battalions of Hamas are already destroyed, eliminated, and actually Hamas does not exist anymore as a functioning, effective military form, there are still four battalions in Rafah. There are still tunnels in Rafah, and we have the Philadelphia corridor, which is the border between Israel, between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, that must be blocked because we have hundreds of tunnels under this corridor that eventually feeds the entire Gaza Strip with ammunition, weapon, and therefore it must be blocked in order to finalize the mission and to assure that Hamas will not exist anymore as a governmental and military entity in the Gaza Strip.
So really, I mean, the potential operation in Rafah is crucial. Is there any way around it? Do you see that there's a scenario whereby they can avoid it and reach a diplomatic understanding with the US and the Egyptians instead? Or in your mind, is that operation essential?
If Israel will be able to reach to a sort of an agreement with the United States, Egypt, Qatar, and Hamas will accept it, that Hamas will dismantle itself in Rafah area, then there will be no need for any military incursion. But if Hamas will refuse, and I assume that Hamas will refuse, there will be no other option but to enter militarily to Rafah area and to dismantle all the infrastructures of Hamas that were left there.
I want to ask a tactical question about the operations in Gaza. One of your books has focused on the role of special forces. How important have they been in the operations and the prosecution of this war?
The special forces of the IDF played a very significant role in this war, and they still do. And all the composition of the IDF is not similar to the traditional composition that we used to know till several years ago. And actually, in each form of a military force that operates in Gaza, we have a special unit or a special force, okay? Or even more than one special force unit. And the idea of jointness and integration and synchronization between the engineering forces, the armored forces, the tanks, the infantry, the Navy and the Air Force and the Special Forces is, and together with the very sophisticated intelligence envelope, is very, very impressive in this regard. And I think that the IDF does just a magnificent work. And what is also very impressive in this regard is the learning process that the IDF goes through from the beginning of the war. I mean, the IDF draws lessons from each battle and from each event and improves itself and changes the tactics and changes the forms. And therefore, we see more and more influential involvement of the special forces.
And another aspect, not quite special forces, but you mentioned the engineering corps having to deal with the extent of the labyrinth of tunnels, which, as you said earlier, 500 kilometers kind of exceeded the expectations, I think, of the military planners. Are you confident that they've found and learned from experience that there is a reasonable and efficient way to dismantle these tunnels, or they still pose a long-term threat?
We began with a huge deficit of knowledge and capacities. Although we prepared ourselves and we knew about the tunnels, we were surprised from the scale and from the sophistication of the tunnels. And it took some time until the engineering forces developed some technologies and developed capacities. But it looks that now this is, I would say, the most experienced engineering force in the entire world with regard to tunnels warfare. And they are doing a great job in this regard.
Could you give us any more details of how they've learned and evolved the tactics they're employing now?
It begins with, first of all, technology and the materials which are used in order to explore the tunnels. It continues with knowledge about the knowledge for differentiating or distinguishing between the different types of the tunnels and to find the centers of gravities of these tunnels and then to collapse them. And it continues with building the capacities to fight into or inside the tunnels, okay, against terrorists that are trying to hide there. All of these capacities, the technological capacities, the operational capacities, intelligence, knowledge, okay, All of these capacities at the end of the day create the capability to deal with this challenge and to dismantle step by step, to dismantle the most significant centers of gravity of these tunnels, of this infrastructure. And I think that at the end of the day, Hamas eventually lost its advantage with regard to the tunnels, and without the tunnels and without the military organized forms, the only option that they have is to return to guerrilla and terror warfare. And with guerrilla and terror warfare, I think that we are very experienced, and therefore they have very, very minimal and little achievements.
But just on that kind of guerrilla warfare, that if you say kind of the IDF has done a good job at dismantling the battalions, still we see reports that even areas that are under IDF control, there are pockets of resistance, and terror cells are able to come out and potentially attack and target the troops. How does one deal with that? What's the scenario in which one can kind of totally kind of vanquish and control the areas?
Look, I think that at the end of the day, we will be forced to establish a temporary military administration in the Gaza Strip. It will begin in the northern part of the Gaza Strip. It will move to Khan Yunis area, to the refugee camps in the center part of the Gaza Strip, and then Rafah. I don't see any other valid option on the table. First of all, in order to secure the distribution of the humanitarian aid, because we don't want that Hamas would do that, and we don't want a chaotic situation or anarchy. And therefore, I don't see any other entity which is able to do the job but the IDF. And in order to do that correctly, you have to be with boots on the ground. You have to be able to connect with locals. You have to build some distribution centers, and you have to secure the convoys of the humanitarian aid. All of these means that we have to be there, and the only possible form that I see is a temporary military administration that will have two additional objectives as well. Generally speaking, three objectives. The first one I spoke about, this is the distribution and the securing of the humanitarian aid. The second objective is to signal to Hamas leadership and to the Gazans that Hamas is not a valid option anymore, or an alternative. And this is something that will affect not only morally the leadership of Hamas, it will affect also the populace of Gaza. And I think that it will decrease or weaken the popular support of the Gazans in Hamas, because most of the Gazans still believe that Hamas is a valid option for the day after the war. And we have to signal that Hamas is not an option, and the military administration will signal it. And the third objective is to prepare the territory and the conditions for the regional or the international or any sort of combination between regional and international task force that will come to the Gaza Strip and will take responsibility for running the territory and the population, and in the very same time to train and to educate a local administration and to transfer in a very gradual and responsible manner authorities to this local administration, in a way that in a process of 3, 4, 5 years, this administration will be capable to remain independent and to run the territory and the population.
Thank you for that. I may come back to you on a couple of those points, but I want to move on for now. As we're talking, we are ahead. Tomorrow is the first Friday of Ramadan, and we're aware of Hamas efforts, both in the past and currently, of trying to ignite the other fronts, which they haven't succeeded so far. The West Bank, Jerusalem, even amongst the Israeli Arab citizens. So far, Jerusalem itself has remained relatively quiet, at least with regard to the Temple Mount itself. I saw reports of 40,000 worshippers there last night, and it all passed off peacefully. However, we have seen an uptick already in the last 2 or 3 days, even one earlier today, of a terror attack in the south, of a stabbing. How concerned are you about kind of the Hamas agenda to spread the violence to other fronts?
I'm very concerned, but it is not only because Hamas wills to ignite the entire fronts, not only Jerusalem. They perceive or they understand that Jerusalem, Al-Aqsa, the Temple Mount, Haram Sharif, it is the explosive barrier that can ignite the entire region, okay, and the entire Islamic world, not only the West Bank or Jerusalem. I'm concerned because this is also the Iranian motivation, and this is I would say an opportunity in their eyes, in the Iranian eyes and Hamas eyes, to bring all the Palestinians and all the Arabs and to operate all the fronts that surrounds Israel in order to achieve what they failed to achieve in the murderous attack of October 7th. Because they believe that if they will be able to ignite the other fronts during the Ramadan, because of the sensitivity of the Ramadan, because of the very unique dynamic that Ramadan has, they will be able to accomplish what they failed, as I say, to accomplish following the attack of October 7th. And therefore, I'm very concerned. And I think that Israel has to be very cautious, very sensitive, very wise in this regard, and to understand what is the potential, the escalation potential, and to do whatever is required to do in order to enable the pilgrims, the worship, the freedom of access to the holy sites, to Haram Sharif. But in the very same time, I think that we have also to assure that the responsibility in this regard will not remain only in the hands of the Israeli police or the Israeli Minister for so-called national security, okay? Due to the very dangerous implication or potential implication and ramification, I think that all of this event must be conducted by the War Cabinet.
I think that's my sense is what that is happening, that the Prime Minister seems to have stripped Ben-Gvir of the policy and control and has taken it over. I wonder if I could just pivot and ask about other policies in the West Bank. I mean, one of the very difficult policy dilemmas is what to do about the 180,000 Palestinian workers that have traditionally come in and earned employment inside Israel, that's been suspended since October the 7th, and whether what you would be advising the Security Cabinet, the War Cabinet, to do over that dilemma at the moment.
It looks that the War Cabinet, or at least the Prime Minister, have decided about it already, and they decided to accept the recommendation of the security establishment to enable a very controlled and gradual entrance of Palestinian workers to Israel. I think that it will be done. I think that they are still looking for the best way to do that. It is not so easy. It's very complicated because it is not only the issue of security, okay, how to secure and to assure that terrorists will not be among the Palestinian workers. But it is also the idea of sense of security of the Israeli people. I mean, the Israeli people inside the state of Israel are scared, and they do not want to see Palestinians. Okay, and an event that you have mentioned at the beginning that has occurred just 3 hours ago in Beit Kamay, the Negev. Okay, where an Arab-Israeli citizen's origin from the Gaza Strip, in the age of 22, stabbed three or four Israelis in a cafe in a gas station, okay, This is something that the Israeli citizens are horrified from. So the idea that dozens of thousands of Palestinians workers will come to work in Israel, where Israel is in a state of war with the Palestinians, it's not something which is normal. I mean, I don't think that we can find such examples in other places in the world, where one country is in a war with another country, or one people with another people, and then some people of the enemy are entering the territory of the other side in order to war. Okay, I mean, this is an idea of normalizing the abnormal. But on the other hand, I think that the Israeli government understands that there is a need to for a relief in the economic situation in the West Bank, and to decrease the pressure and to prevent Palestinian workers from joining the crowd, the Palestinian crowd, and to become part of the cycle of violence or terrorism. And it looks that at the end of the day, the government will find the right way to do that, but it will be in small numbers. If we are talking about 180,000 Palestinian workers, I think that the number will not be more than 20 or 30,000, at least in the first phase.
Right. I hear that. Okay, thank you. Another question specifically about Hamas, and this kind of also relates to the background that people had hoped that there would be another hostage exchange and release that haven't yet come to fruition. But I want to first ask you about the current kind of balance of power within the Hamas leadership between Sinwar inside Gaza and Hanir and the others who are the external leadership. Where do you think the power balance currently sits?
I think that this is an excellent question because, you know, Richard, people tend to relate to Hamas as a monolithic entity, and Hamas is not a monolithic entity, a very disciplined one, much more disciplined than Fatah, but it is not a monolithic entity. And you are right that there are gaps and differences between the Gazan leadership of Hamas and the external leadership of Hamas, be it Ismail Haniyeh or Khaled Mash'al. And by the way, there are differences between Khaled Mash'al and Ismail Haniyeh as well, and both of them are from the external leadership. I think that the Gazan leadership is much more strict and less flexible than the external leadership. I think that Yahya Sinwar is a much tougher guy than Ismail Haniyeh. And it looks that the Gazan leadership believes that the time works in favor of them because they know exactly what is going there on the ground. They see the built tension between Israel and the United States. They see that the international community pressures Israel with regard to humanitarian aid, and the Americans above the head of the Israelis are going to deal with or to build the maritime pier or dock in the northern part of Gaza. And they see what is going here in Israel. I mean, the growing tension between those who demand an immediate release of the hostages and those who are not ready to accept it. And they believe that at the end of the day, they will be able to exhaust the Israeli society, to exhaust the state of Israel, that the state of Israel will be forced by the international community, mainly by the Americans, to cease the war, and they will remain as a military and governmental entity in the Gaza Strip. And therefore, they have no incentive to be more flexible with regard to the hostages negotiation or deal. I think that the external leadership of Hamas sees things differently. I think that they understand that the time doesn't work in favor of Hamas, and they really horrified from the idea that the IDF will invade Rafah and they believe that the IDF will invade Rafah, and the only chance to prevent the IDF from invading Rafah is to bring a good deal to the table. And this is the reason that they are ready to be more flexible. But this is not the situation in Gaza itself. Now psychology plays a role, and who knows what is going between the 2 years of Yahya Sinwar and what actually drives his motivation. But at the end of the day, and in the bottom line, we are in a situation where Israel accepted the principles or the framework of the mediators, and Hamas rejected it.
And do you think that, there's talk that the Qatari pressure or kind of US pressure on Qatar can in turn pressurize the external leadership. Do you buy that formulation, or does it need to come from inside? Where's the where can the pressure be brought to bear?
There is no doubt about it. I mean, unfortunately, the Americans just recently began pushing and pressuring Qatar. Qatar has the most effective leverage over Hamas, and Qatar is part of the problem and not part of the solution. And I think that the idea that the U.S. administration appeased Qatar and assisted Qatar to be the princess of diplomacy here in the region, and didn't pressure Qatar in the first day of the war, eventually brought us to this moment. And we have to understand that Qatar is the biggest supporter of Hamas, and not only of Hamas, by the way. Qatar is a country, a state that supports terrorism, generally speaking. Qatar till today supports jihadi, Salafist terror organization in the entire Middle East. And Qatar is a subversive, I would say, factor with regard to the United States, even on the American soil, when they are hiring private detectives in order to follow, you know, congressmen and senators who dare to criticize Qatar and to make a shaming in order to pressure them to stop them from pressuring Qatar. I think that if Qatar will be much more serious in this regard, and if Qatar will not only declare that they will throw out Hamas leaders from the Qatari soil, but they will do it, and that they will stop immediately supporting Hamas financially or politically, and if they will stop the incitement of Al Jazeera, I think that we will reach to a very successful deal.
Yes, from your mouth, as they say, those kind of the pressure that of the role that Al Jazeera has been playing over a decade and a half here is kind of wringing untold damage. Do you see a scenario in which that's realistic to prevent, to cut them down, or to moderate them?
It depends on the Americans. Look, Qatar is a very fun. This is an absurd. Qatar is a very funny country, a very teeny one, small country with less than 400,000 residents or citizens and 1.5 modern slaves. Okay. Qatar is not able to run its own military. They use Pakistani pilots, okay, in order to activate their air force. And Qatar, without the defense of the United States, without the guarantees of the United States, without the special status as a non-NATO ally, okay, they will not exist 2 days. They will not be able to exist. The United States of America just have to say to Qatar, you have 24 hours, okay, First of all, to expel out all Hamas leaders from your soil. Secondly, to stop immediately any kind of support in Hamas. And thirdly, to shut down Al Jazeera, or at least to assure that Al Jazeera will stop inciting. And if you are not going to do that, you are going to be left alone. And then let's see what is going to be with Qatar. The problem that instead of doing that, we saw that 3 or 4 days ago, the State Department released an official document that describes the strategic relation between the United States of America and its ally Qatar here in the Middle East. Okay, and all of this document glorifies Qatar and the special relations between Qatar and the United States. I mean, it's just an absurd. I cannot understand that. Instead of bringing Qatar on its knees, okay, the United States of America is appeasing Qatar and glorifying Qatar and enable Qatar to be a very significant regional player with international intentions and aspirations as well. And in the very same time, Qatar plays against the interests of the United States. Just for an example, Qatar cooperates with China and Russia with regard to the changes in the formation of the Security Council of the UN. Not talking about what Qatar does with regard to the academic institutions in the United States and with regard to some other things on the American soil.
Thank you for that. If we can go back to the Palestinian sector, Abu Mazen announced a new prime minister of the PA. What can you tell us about Mohamed Mustafa and what his appointment means?
The appointment means nothing. If people think that this is something that indicates or signals the beginning of the revitalized Palestinian Authority, I think that he or she has to rethink about it. Look, as long as Abu Mazen hold the reins, Abu Mazen and the close circles around him, which are the old guard of Fatah, the PLO, nothing will be changed in the Palestinian Authority. No significant reform will be held. There is no a difference between Muhammad and Muhammad. There is no difference in Muhammad Ishtaya, the prime minister that resigned, and Muhammad Mustafa, the prime minister that might maybe will be appointed or nominated by Abu Mazen. Both of them belong to the closest cycle to of Abu Mazen, and Mohammed Mustafa is a member in the executive committee of the PLO. He used to be the deputy prime minister and a minister. He is the closest advisor to Abu Mazen. He's economic advisor, okay. And he is part of the old guard. So I do not believe that he will be able to grow a backbone that will enable him to criticize Abu Mazen or to challenge Abu Mazen and to initiate very significant reforms in the Palestinian Authority, like the reforms that were initiated, for example, by Salam Fayyad. Because this is exactly the difference between of them. Salam Fayyad is not a political entity. Salam Fayyad does not belong to Fatah. He has no political base among the Palestinians, and he was, I would say, a technocrat, but a very ambitious one and a very talented one. And eventually, I think that he was very respected by the entire international community, by Israel, and by the Palestinian people. But he was not respected by Abu Mazen, by the old guard, and therefore they throw him away because he dealt with the nepotism, with the corruption. He did real reforms in the security establishment. He did many important things that disconnected the old guard from all the resources of the PA, and they didn't like the idea. They felt that they are losing control, and they throw him away. And they came back to the old tradition of the PLO. You know, Richard, if I have to summarize in one sentence, what is the historical tragedy and failure of the Palestinian people is the idea that the Palestinian leadership eventually failed to do the transition process from a revolutionary resistance national movement, which is the PLO, to a state, okay, or to a state building process, which is the Palestinian Authority. And eventually they duplicated the political and the organizational DNA of the PLO to the Palestinian Authority. They brought from the PLO the corruption, the nepotism, and all the organizational culture of the PLO, and they were not concentrated or not willing or not interested in building an independent functioning Palestinian state. I mean, not interested, I mean Arafat and Abu Mazen. They were mainly interested in sabotaging and destroying the Zionist project. And therefore, as long as Abu Mazen and his old guard are there, nothing good will come out from the Palestinian Authority.
So that takes me on to just my final question, really, that you mentioned before about the UC, that there is going to necessarily be a military administration over Gaza in the short term. But I just wanted to take your thoughts on what that looks like in the longer term, and any prospect, what we need to see happen to build a viable Palestinian state in the future.
I can tell you what is my vision, okay? And I hope sure. This vision will be adopted by the others as well. I think that that the key is the new regional architecture that should be formed here. And I think that all the Palestinian issues should be dealt or should be conducted under the umbrella of the new regional architecture, which should be based on the normalization process between Israel and the Arab countries, mainly Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia is the leader of the Arab world and the Sunni Islamic world, and it is a very, very important country. And I think that the two Palestinian entities, the Gaza Strip and the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, should go through a reconstruction and reforms process separately, not together. I don't think that the Palestinian Authority under the current circumstances can do something positive in the Gaza Strip. The Palestinian Authority currently cannot deal with its own challenges in the West Bank, which is much less complicated than the Gaza Strip. And the current Palestinian Authority suffers from a huge deficit of legitimacy among all the Palestinian constituencies. So the Palestinian Authority is not the solution for the Gaza Strip. And I think that the Gaza Strip should go through a reconstruction process that will be conducted by a sort of an international trusteeship, which is a form of an international regional task force that will come to the Gaza Strip and will have the responsibility to run the territory and the population and the reconstruction process of the entire Gaza Strip in parallel to educating and training process of the local administration of Gaza. And in parallel to this process in the Gaza Strip, the Palestinian Authority will go through a very significant reforms process that will enable it to build its capacities, to build state institutions, to build civil society, economy, functioning security apparatuses, infrastructures, and so on and so forth. These two processes will be conducted in parallel under the umbrella of the regional architecture. And in a five-year process or so, we can talk about the Palestinian Federation that will be composed of two major districts, the District of Gaza and the District of the West Bank. And who knows, maybe later on, there will be a confederation between Jordan and the Palestinian Federation. But the bilateral level between Israel and the Palestinians has been exhausted. Nothing good will come out of that. Water from this rock will not come out, okay? And I think that the only alternative that exists is the multilateral level. The multilateral level means this is the synonym of the new regional architecture. And if I will use the jargon of conflict resolution, or I would say that making the transformation from the bilateral level that has been exhausted already to the multilateral level, which is the regional architecture, we are enlarging the pie. What does it mean, enlarging the pie? It means that we bring new players, additional players, new and additional agendas, new and additional interests, and mainly new and additional resources. The multilateral level, which is the regional architecture, will provide the Israelis and the Palestinians with opportunities that do not exist in the bilateral level. These opportunities will create much broader spaces of flexibility and concessions, and both sides will be able to be compensated by the regional architecture for their flexibility and concessions, things that cannot be done in the bilateral level. And therefore, I think that the key is the regional architecture, and everything should be conducted under the umbrella of this architecture. And if there is a future to the Palestinian independence, to the Palestinian state, is in this context. But in order to assure that it will be realized, the Palestinian society must go through a very severe change of its psychological infrastructure, because when we are talking about a situation or a reality where 82% of the entire Palestinian population supports the massacre of October 7th, and Hamas gains such a broad popularity among the Palestinian constituency, then we are talking about a very problematic psychological infrastructure that must be changed. And the second change must be in the Palestinian leadership. I do not believe that the current Palestinian leadership, means Abu Mazen and the old guard of Fatah, are capable, able, and willing to make the required change in order to realize the vision that I have described before.
Fascinating. Well, thank you so much for all your analysis today. Most appreciated. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me.